From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I am from Livermore.
I'm from East Oakland.
Oakland, near Lake Merritt.
Alameda, California.
I'm in the Excelsior neighborhood.
Cambridge, Massachusetts, but I grew up in Sonoma County.
Coming up, what's killing California trees by the tens of thousands?
When they're brown like this, they're dead. They're not coming back.
Then a local journalist travels to Saudi Arabia to hear what women there have to say.
Women are telling me, you don't get it. You people don't understand who we are and what we want, and we're sick of it.
And a local author's recommended reading.
It's a book about growing up in a really strange family and trying to escape from it and find out who you are.
We'll find out a lot more than that today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. There still may be a few more rainy days left while El Niño is here, but scientists are looking beyond the rainy weather and focusing their attention on the coming fire season. They're looking to prevent another big one, like last September's fire in Lake County, when over 76,000 acres of forest burned. Thousands of already dead, dry trees fueled the flames, and those trees, many of them were killed by one tiny culprit, the bark beetle. This native pest works by chewing its way through trees. In California, the numbers are unprecedented. Right now, more than 29 million dead trees in the state are waiting to fall or burn. KALW's Angela Johnston took a closer look at this arboreal epidemic.
If you need help finding dead trees and bark beetles, Tom Smith is your guy. He works for the California Department of Forestry and Fire, identifying and managing tree diseases and pests.
I'm just a bugs and rot man.
A bugs and rot man.
And if you want to find bugs and rot close to the Bay Area, Smith says head up to Mount Diablo in Contra Costa County. So I meet him there, in a parking lot at the base of the mountain. He points up a steep hill to a green pine forest, blemished by brown, dying trees.
They are evergreen trees. When they're brown like this, they're dead. They're not coming back.
Smith grabs his pocket knife and we hike up the hill.
What we've got here is actually the northernmost stand of culture pine in California. And it's getting really walloped by what are called Ips engraver beetles.
Ips engravers are just one of many species of bark beetles.
The big one in California is western pine beetle, and it's the one that's killed, we're guessing, around 29 million pine trees this year. It's a lot of dead trees.
And Smith says that estimate is on the low side. The dying ones out here probably weren't counted when the state did a flyover survey last October. Usually, 1% of trees die each year due to insects, disease, overcrowding, or fire. Right now, Smith says we're dealing with annual mortality rates in the 25 to 80% range. Climate change and the past 4 years of record drought have made the trees weaker.
And the bark beetles really like trees that are under stress, and the drought puts the trees under stress. We're going to go up here and then turn.
Okay.
And it's up.
That's fine.
Okay.
We eventually reach a group of small pine trees. The needles on some of them are green. Others have a singed look. Their branches droop. Some have no leaves at all.
In fact, we might be able to see if we can see some beetles on them. What happens is the beetles actually attack the tree. They're feeding right under the bark. Most of them are about the size of a grain of rice or smaller.
Okay.
Blackish in color, pretty nondescript looking unless you know what you're looking for. But they're attacking it by the thousands.
Bark beetles can fly up to 2 miles to find a tree to attack. Once they find one, they bore their way inside. If the beetle is successful, it releases pheromones that tell other beetles to come on over. Inside the tree, the beetles eat the inner layer of the bark.
And they'll girdle the tree, so no water and nutrients are moving up and down the tree anymore.
Smith can't tell me how many trees on Mount Diablo are infested with bark beetles, but he does say it's nothing compared to how many trees are dying in the southern Sierra Nevada, almost 80%. And right now, the dead trees are a major fire hazard.
They're around all these communities. So they're adding just a fuel load to the forest that they don't need. They're already having major fires down there. We don't need more fires. But if we can't get this wood out, that it's just going to sit there and be more fuel that can burn in more fires, more huge fires in the future.
That's where the state comes in. Last fall, Governor Brown issued an emergency proclamation urging city, regional, and state agencies to bypass environmental regulations to cut down trees. Trees that have already burned, and also ones that are losing the battle with bark beetles, in danger of burning later. But right now, sawmills around the state are completely full, and there aren't enough bioenergy facilities to turn 29 million dead trees into fuel. So the state is looking to create new markets for dead California trees. And you don't have to look further than Lake County, 2 hours north of San Francisco, to see this happening. On Cobb Mountain in Lake County, the land still bears the scars from last fall's devastating valley fire. Most of the hills are still charred black. There are patches of green forest here and there where a sudden change of wind steered the flames in a different direction. But these green surviving trees may not be here for much longer, because in Lake County, bark beetles are killing most of what is left.
This is a new area right here that's, I'd say they've been in here probably at least 4 months.
Danny Prather is a fifth-generation timber operator. Basically, that means he has a permit to cut down trees. This year, he says more than half the trees he's cutting down are ones that have already been infested by beetles.
That patch of orange right up there, a couple hundred yards, that I cut every tree in there last year that I thought was going to die. And even with that and removing the ones with active beetles still in it, they still come back and spread.
Today, he's cutting down, or felling, a few ponderosa pine trees to thin out the forest near his house. A sparser group of trees makes it harder for bark beetles to move from tree to tree. Prather says mills in California don't want to buy pine. It's not as valuable as redwood or cedar. And because the local mills are full, he, along with the rest of the state, has to find other markets for the wood. This tree and the dozens of others he'll fell this year will get put on a truck bed, transported to the port of Richmond, put on a boat, and shipped to China. Prather will make just enough money to break even.
They're paying more than our own mills, which I don't know how that can work out financially. But more importantly, it gets our dead wood out of the forest, which is a good thing.
Clearing trees that are already dead is good for preventing fires, but some experts think we shouldn't be so quick to cut the green ones down and ship them away. Here's UC Berkeley law professor Eric Bieber.
One of the concerns is that if people cut trees instead of letting the beetles kill the trees, in the long run, that may actually interfere with the ability of these forests and these pine species to adapt to a future of climate change.
Bieber co-authored a paper with environmental scientist Diana Six that suggested waiting to see what bark beetles could tell us about climate change and how trees could fight back.
So the argument would be that the trees that survive bark beetle infestations are likely to be adapted to better resist them. Those are the trees that will reproduce going forward. So you will, over time, the beetles select for the trees that are best able to resist them.
Basically, they want to let natural selection run its course. But he admits it's hard to sit by when beautiful green vistas around California are starting to fade away.
A lot of places and ecosystems that we are used to living in, and that we associate looking in a certain way and feeling in a certain way, will start changing. And we'll have these urges to do something about it. And it's not clear to me that we will be doing good things.
On the ride back down from Danny Prather's land on Cobb Mountain, I passed the Bog Demonstration State Forest. It used to be a recreation area that was also used for research. Now it's full of dead trees, 90% of them burned in the Valley Fire. For many here in Lake County, the view is a constant reminder of the huge loss the fire brought to this community. But some people see an opportunity, The forest could be a blank slate, a place to plant and test different trees that could resist future beetle attacks, and maybe find a way to manage the epidemic by planting trees instead of cutting them down. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Bhava. For decades, the media has treated the Saudi Arabian woman as the poster child for female oppression. But recent changes in the kingdom are challenging that image. In 2011, the late King Abdullah, a reformer, granted women the right to vote. 2 years later, Saudi women were given seats on the Shura Council, or the Saudi Parliament. Just last December, women voted for the first time and were allowed to join their local city councils. And the number of employed Saudi women has increased by 48% since 2010. UC Berkeley journalism professor Cynthia Gorney was intrigued by this changing society, so she visited Saudi Arabia to spend time with the women there. She wrote an article for National Geographic titled "The Changing Face of Saudi Women." Gorney joined me in studio, and I asked her what the women had to say.
Before I ever became interested in this project, I, who make a living talking to people that I don't agree with and trying to learn about things that I don't understand that are out of my experience, had the same kind of blanket prejudices about Saudi Arabia as many of my very well-educated and internationally sophisticated friends, which was to say it outraged me. The gender relations outraged me. And I would say, how is it, a very familiar line for all of us, how is it that the U.S. can have friendly relations with a country that enslaves its entire female population? How is it that we could do what we did with South Africa, which is to say, you can't do this. This is not internationally acceptable, and we will cut off all economic ties with you, but not do that with Saudi Arabia. That was my attitude. And you and I could talk for hours about that question, but the first thing that I had to learn when I finally did begin to read about Saudi and arrive was that my job was to listen to women, just listen to women. And the first, I mean, I must have had 300 long conversations in the 2 months that I spent in Saudi Arabia. And the first 20 of them that you have were not exactly to a woman, but almost to a woman. Women are telling me, you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You people don't understand who we are and what we want and how we think and why we live this way, and you're always judging us, and we're sick of it. We're over it. The first 19 of those conversations that you have, you really sober up in any notion you might have had about lecturing these women.
And this is you, the person actually coming to listen.
Absolutely.
And you're getting this.
And I'm not going to say people were hostile to me at all. Once they saw that I was genuinely there to listen and not lecture them, they could not have been more warm, inviting, and friendly. I mean, people just come to my house, come to this place, come to that place, let's talk. And the women would say to me that their chief complaint about the way that outsiders look at them is that we obsess on the wrong things. We obsess, the Saudi women would tell me, on their inability to, for example, go swimming in a swimming pool with men.
Or driving? Did that come up a lot?
Oh,
because
of course. Well, one of the ways I found that I would bond with Saudi women was by saying fairly quickly, I promise you, this is not another driving story. And they would say, okay, great, let's talk. Now, there are plenty of Saudi women who believe that the refusal to issue driver's licenses to women is stupid. We don't understand that there are two things that irritates the vast majority of Saudis about the outside's obsession with their driving restrictions. One is that we equate driving with independence in a way that we, especially in California, equate driving. I mean, when I was 16 and got my driver's license, it meant I was free. For Saudis, that is not necessarily the case. Driving is a pain no matter who's doing it in Saudi Arabia. The roads are awful. The city traffic is horrific. And many Saudi women I talked to were really irritated and insulted that we would imagine that their notion of freedom is tied up in whether they can get behind the wheel of their own car. So number one is that you don't understand why we need to drive. We need to drive because it's very expensive for us to hire a driver, because it's a pain for us to get to work if we cannot, because et cetera, et cetera.
Not because of freedom.
We have, you misunderstand what freedom is, they would say. You think freedom is the ability to jump in a swimming pool with a guy and drive your car and be in the same shopping mall store with a guy. We don't think that's it. So that's part of it.
And then that comfort aspect, would that come in here as well, that I'm comfortable,
yes.
I am being driven everywhere?
Yes. And then a lot of women would say to me, I certainly met a number of women who were enormously irritated that they could not drive. And I met women who were involved in the driving protests who felt that this was a deep offense and that the only way to keep going was protesting. But I met a lot more women, I will say, just numerically, who, while not angry at the protesting women, felt that the protesting women needed to shut up because what they were doing was counterproductive and they were setting off the most conservative elements of Saudi society, and they had turned this act of transportation into a much larger matter that had to do with becoming Western, forgetting who we are as Saudis. And once again, the Saudi prescription, this is another thing that I certainly hadn't understood, and I think a lot of my friends had not understood. The Saudi rules and cultural practices about women not driving are not primarily, at least in my experience, based in the idea that women are incapable of driving a car. They are based in the idea that women would be unsafe because, once again, if women and men are allowed to mingle in the open, great harm will come to women because, fundamentally, women radiate powerful sexuality and men are uncontrollable. And that is kind of the guiding principle of many levels of Saudi organization. So I would say that at the class level that I was talking to, educated people, the majority speaking English, not heavy protesters, aggravated with many aspects of Saudi society, but equally aggravated in some ways with American misconceptions of Saudi society, they would say, let it go. Let us do this. It's going to take some time. We are going to be driving. It may not happen next year. It may not happen then in the next 5 years. We are going to be driving, and you all need to shut up about it.
What do you want people here in the United States to really, really get out of your article at the end of the day?
I would like the next time one of us here on the streets of the Bay Area sees a woman who happens to be wearing an abaya and niqab, I would like you not to recoil or not to think, what an oppressed woman, but to make it disappear and to see the woman who's inside and try somehow to listen to her, and do that with the entire nation of Saudi women who are, they have a million voices. To say that they have a thing to tell us is as condescending as saying Americans, women, have a thing to tell us. We come in every imaginable form and point of view, but so do Saudi women. And I think the thing that angers them overall most is the notion that we feel sorry for them, or that we understand in a way that they do not, that they're oppressed. Mm. So getting loose of those kinds of preconceptions would be the main thing I would hope my piece could do.
That's UC Berkeley journalism professor Cynthia Gorney. She wrote a National Geographic article called The Changing Face of Saudi Women. Find a link at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. Thank you. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for the book report, brought to you by the Litography Project.
Ah, the Litography Project!
Shh. Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
Each book report, we ask Bay Area writers to tell us about a book that's meaningful for them. Today, we hear from San Francisco-based author Charlie Jane Anders.
We put up our tent on a dark green knoll outside of town by the train tracks and a seagull dump.
My name is Charlie Jane Anders, and my book report is on Geek Love by Catherine Dunn.
She bottle-fed an orangutan named Tripod.
Contrary to what you might expect, is not about computer geeks or people who fix, you know, your broken hardware. It's actually about circus geeks.
And Mighty Tiny on the saw.
And it's about this family who work at a circus, and business is not so good. So they decide to use chemicals and radiation and stuff to turn their children into mutants in the hopes that their children will be good circus freaks and they can make some money off of them. But one of the children, Arturo, aka Artie, aka the Aqua Boy, becomes kind of a religious cult leader and gets a huge following and basically makes the other kids' lives hell. You know, it's a very literary book, but it goes into all these very strange places with, you know, telekinetic characters and characters who have strange abilities. But also, it's just a book that really captures something very vital about being alive and dealing with your family and trying to figure out where you belong. It's just a book that keeps taking amazing risks, and they all pay off. But I love this one passage about Arturo, Aqua Boy, kind of speaking to his new audience / followers. The Aqua Boy changed again. For a while, he answered only generic questions distilled from the scrawled bewilderments and griefs that piled up on the 3x5 cards. Then he stopped answering at all and just told them what he wanted them to hear. Testifying, he called it. What Artie wanted the crowds to hear was that they were all hormone-driven insects and probably deserved to be miserable, but that he, the Aqua Boy, could really feel for them because he is in much better shape. That's what it sounded like to me, but the customers must have been hearing something different because they gobbled it up, and they seemed to enjoy feeling sorry for themselves. You might figure a mood like that would be bad for the carnival business, but it worked the opposite way. The crowd streaming out from Artie's act would plunge deeper into the midway than all the rest, as though cantankerously determined to treat themselves to the joys of junk food and simp twisters to make up for the misery that had just been revealed to them. The fact that people actually enjoy being told that they're terrible and being made miserable, and that this actually is good for business and makes them better consumers. It's ironic, but it feels true. It doesn't feel just like gratuitously ironic. It feels like a real observation about the messed up nature of human beings. It's also a book that captures this real feeling of what it's like to be an outsider and to feel in some sense that you're superior to normal people, which I think is something that isn't often acknowledged in books about outsiders and people who are unusual, is the sense of like kind of looking down on as they're called in this book, the norms. It's just a great book about being different.
Today's book report was produced by Hannah Kingsley Ma for the Litography Project. She spoke with Charlie Jane Anders, whose most recent book, All the Birds in the Sky, is set in San Francisco. She's also the editor-in-chief of io9.com and the organizer of the reading series Writers with Drinks. To find out more, go to our website, kalw.org, click Cross Currents. And if you've just read a book you want to tell us about, we'd love to hear about it. Call us, leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by The Bogues. They play on St. Patrick's Day at the Makeout Room in San Francisco starting at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.